Welcome, Jim. Welcome, Marita.
Thank you. I feel very welcome.
Damien, I want to introduce you to a friend of mine, a colleague of mine, and an inspiration of mine, Marita Davies. We've worked together for almost 7 years. She's one of our key partners at Tank, as are you. And we've been working together for a good 7 year chunk. And we've also got to know each other's families and our worlds as well. And I think she's one of the most remarkable people to have as part of one of our conversations, because she's inspired me. You've inspired me, Marita. I shouldn't be talking about you while you're sitting right here. One of the things that you've inspired me about in the last few years is your deep connection to your cultural identity, which I find completely empowering, simply because in my experience, I never got to experience that. So I'd love to talk to you about that today.
Sure.
And I'd love to also learn more. I'd love to talk to you about clown school.
Oh, I didn't realize that was coming up. Okay.
And I'd love to talk to you about the importance of storytelling.
Yeah.
And you need to talk about your mum.
She's a firecracker.
Yeah. Okay. So, Marita, welcome to our conversations. This began as a conversation between a friend of mine and I, where we felt that two people, especially two men in this world, need to sit down and have a vulnerable conversation about something.
Yeah.
That's where we began. And that's really important to you and I, isn't it, Damien?
Look, it is. It is, Jim, and welcome, Marita. It's a great privilege to have you here. I know Jim speaks highly of you, your background, and I've read a bit about your profile and the things you're up to. And I'm also really interested to hear about clown school as well, because I've had a little bit to do in that space recently. But I
really
want to hear about your space as well. So
I had no idea you even knew about that. What digging have you done?
You told me about it.
A forensic. We've had forensic examination.
No, we had a conversation many years ago and you told me the story about it. So why don't we start there?
Sure.
Tell us about.
Well, I suppose as a young graduate of theatre, I wanted to do it, but I kind of did theatre, but not knowing deep down that that's not really what I wanted to do, but it was fun and I followed the fun. So I'd heard about clown school and I was at a time in my life, I think I was 23 when I went. It's in Paris. It's run by a man called Guyer and he is renowned for teaching clowns. He taught Sacha Baron Cohen.
Wow.
Like his big student, but many, many other people go there, especially for a summer school. So lots of actors go in to learn how to be a clown, which sounds, I think people have this assumption of what learning to be a clown is, which is, you know, a correct assumption of, you know, the big shoes and the water being spurted out of the flower kind of thing and red nose. But it's not that at all. It's almost how to be silly in life. And it was like a life class, really. And it was quite confronting because, you know, your first session, you get up there and I couldn't understand his accent. So I ended up being quite annoying to him, the teacher, because I'd sit so close to him because I couldn't understand him if I was far away. So I was sitting right close up to him. And on the first day, there's, you know, maybe 30 people in the class and he just points at you and says, get up and be funny.
So you've actually got to do that improv and just find the stuff. But I think that's fantastic. That is such a good place for you to go, because that's uncomfortable, isn't it? That's going to make you find your body or make you sort of get out of your head.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, I think the longer you sat there, you're waiting like for him to point at you to say, get up and be funny. And the most intimidating thing is that this sounds so ridiculous, but it was enjoyable at the time, but also quite terrifying. He sits there with a little hand drum. and as soon as you get up, at some point I would say maybe 29 out of 30 people, at some point he would bang the drum and go, awful, sit down. And sometimes you would even just stand up ready to go and he'd bang his drum and be like, no. And you're like, oh. okay, that was it.
That's good training.
Yeah. But I thought it was hilarious. I really did. Whereas I know some other people really were confronted by his techniques. Yes. And they really saw it as an insult to who they were. And as the class went on and as the course went on, he was able to find what was unique about you and bring out that joy and that right. And really it's just showing this joy on stage. And so it took me ages. I was just, you know, I was constantly being, you know, the drums bang, sit down, you know, he would say, that weird Australian girl that sits too close, like, sit down, you're annoying. And I'd be like, oh, okay, which I thought he was funny. But eventually I realized I sort of didn't mean to, but just one day I got up and I just could not stop laughing. And then the rest of the class were laughing at me and then I was laughing at them. And I wasn't putting on an act. It was just...
It was genuine.
It was totally genuine.
A really deep place inside of you.
Yeah.
But what I mean, you know, Jim and I, like lately in the last few sessions, we've been talking about the beautiful exploration of play, finding the little kid, letting go of the tension, the facade, finding that beautiful creative spirit.
Yeah.
And I think that's a fantastic thing for you to have gone through. And we're often pushing people on the podcast, we're challenging them to do that stuff. And it might sound a little bit insane at first, but I think it's a perfect place to be.
Yeah, I think it's a place where, to be honest, I feel quite comfortable with. I grew up with my dad as a music teacher and I was constantly being entered into a Steadfords that I didn't know about, and my dad would forget to tell me. And then sometimes the day before he'd say, oh, I entered you in to do a solo.
No.
You've got three to do tomorrow. And I'd be like, I don't, Dad.
Get out of here.
You didn't tell me.
Yeah. The day before, he just puts you on the spot and he says you've got a solo That's performance. Great.
Yeah.
That is fantastic.
I never, like, it was constant because he organised the local music at Steadfords. And so he'd want the numbers up. And so he'd enter my sister and I in. And suddenly we're up on stage performing to people. And, like, there were times where I was reading music for the first time on stage playing it. Another time I got up on stage and I just knew it was going so bad that I just stopped and started laughing. I was like, what am I doing here? Like, that's Dad, brilliant. Like, I think I was maybe 16 at the time and I was looking to the side going, this is your fault, Dad.
Like, what was driving him? What was the sort of thing? What do you reckon he was doing that for?
I think he knew that I was okay to do it. Okay. I had the personality to just, throw me in a situation and I won't drown. And he needed, you know... He organised the local Steadford and so he had funding and he needed a certain amount of entries to get in there. So, I was just kept busy.
I love that. And maybe just going back to your clown, what have you taken from those sort of experiences with that play and that sort of awkwardness and finding laughter? What, I mean, it's just, you know, when you reflect on that time.
I think the idea of being a clown is really just showing your vulnerabilities and finding joy in awkward spaces, and also not taking yourself seriously. Like, if you suddenly just think this is ridiculous, this world that we're living in, suddenly, you know, I think that's what spurred on that laughter that day where I finally found some sort of measure of success. Was I was like, I'm dressed here as a butcher in the middle of Paris. I can't understand my teacher. He keeps telling me that I'm bad, banging a drum at me. This is the most ridiculous thing you could do. And that realization of, like, what am I doing here? Why have I put myself in this situation? And it was just hilarious. And I think it was this realization, and he saw it in me as well. Like, she is finally getting it. This world is absolutely bonkers. And all we can do is just laugh at ourselves to get through it. And then suddenly that joy spreads. And I didn't get banged off the stage. He was like, you were okay today. I was like, great.
I'm sure you're closer to answering those questions now, many years later. What are you doing here? Why did I do this?
Yeah.
Yeah, of course you are.
Well, but also, you know, what are we doing?
Yeah.
Who cares? Of course. It doesn't matter. It's fun.
That's right. I love what you said, that some people actually found it as an insult into who they were.
Yeah.
That's fascinating, isn't it? And as Damien said last week, we were talking about, you know, stepping into these adjacent spaces. Damien stepped into the acting world. He did some work in theatre just because to actually get into a difficult, uncomfortable space. And I'm actually fascinated by that what you just said, an insult into who they were. People actually felt that people have such a guard up in those situations.
They do. I mean, I remember there was, and I have more empathy now that I am a mother, but there was one woman there who got up and, you know, on her first day, she got up and failed to be funny and he kept her up on stage. She was Australian as well, actually, the other Australian in the class. And he said, "What are you doing here?" And she said, "I don't know." And he said, "Well, what do you do in your life?" And she said, "I am a mother and that's all I've done for 5 years and maybe I'm trying to find myself." And he was like, "Well, that's nice to know, but today you were bad." And so that's really shocking. Like, that's really – I would never treat someone that way.
No.
But at the end of the day, she was able to let go of this mother – not end of the day, end of the course, she was able to let go of this – motherhood identity and just be silly. And she was kind of doing this kind of, "Well, fuck you.
Yeah.
I'm, you know, I am funny. I am. Like, here I am. I've come all the way to Paris. You know, my husband's taken time off to have the kids and, you know, I'm trying to do this juggle and now you've gotten me dressed up as a wrestler." Like, and she was really, her way of being funny was that she was standing there in this ridiculous costume and she was like, "Well, fuck you." And he's like, "Why fuck me?" And she's like, "Because, you know." And
because they, I can.
And she suddenly got this like, "How dare you call me that? How dare you say I can't? You know, that's ridiculous." And it was hilarious because she was just so annoyed at him that the rest of us were laughing. So she was able to find her own way of handling these situations and being her full self in a place of uncomfortableness.
You know, Marita, there's such a beauty in when someone can provoke and push and pull, and it's uncomfortable. And I've been there, and I know that some of the most transformative moments I've had in my life when I've had older people push me and say, "Mate, you're bullshitting. Stop it." Or, "What are you doing there?" And you just, but when it comes from a rich place of good intent, "I'm going to push you, I'm going to provoke you, and because I need something from you," when it's done well, I think it's a fantastic thing.
Yeah, I think you have to ensure that the places are safe.
Yes, of course.
And you have to understand the relationship of, you know, in this particular context that we're talking about, is there was a teacher and a student relationship. And so he had, and because she'd signed up for the course, she'd almost kind of given him permission to push her.
Yes. Mm.
I also think there are some personalities that can
do that.
Do that, and others can't. And he knew when he was pushing it too far.
That's really interesting. I read a paper recently. It was sent by a friend, and I'm going to balls this up. I'm going to say this out loud, right? It talked about the difference between safe spaces and brave spaces, where a safe space is actually everyone's comfortable. And when everyone's comfortable, we can't actually challenge each other.
Yeah.
You know, because we're going to rock the boat of comfort. But a brave space, and I know these are words, and we're just mincing words here, but a brave space is actually a space where everyone feels brave and safe to challenge one another's opinions and call one another out in a safe environment where everyone has the courage to turn up as themselves. And I'll paraphrase what you just said, to find what it is that is unique about us and then simply find joy in that. And to go back to what I was saying, to find our courage in that. It was a really fascinating paper, and it just created this clarity between what we actually need in those spaces. And it's much more than just safety, isn't it?
Yeah, that's so true. Mm. I think it's because there are some places where you want to be, you're turning up asking to be pushed. And then there are other times where you're turning up being like, "Don't push me."
Yeah,
that's right.
I just want to be.
Yeah. When I first met you, I remember the day I met you, Marita,
I remember.
Yeah, I remember the day I met you. It was really special. You walked into our office and I met this person that was really in touch with who they were, Damien. Exactly what you just said, Marita, to find what is unique about you. And you might have not have known that, but you exuded that. And I found that immensely powerful. Okay. Those first couple of weeks of when we first met, you told me this story about how you went back to Kiribati and you called it the land of my grandmother. And for someone in their 40s who's grew up with a parent of migrants like myself in an Australia that was extremely racist, extremely divisive, and I must say not much has changed, yeah, who experienced racism myself, I found that enormously enlightening and enriching to see someone who was so connected to use words like that. I returned back to the land of my grandmother. It was very special for me because I struggled in my lifetime, and only probably in the last decade of my life have I been able to connect deeply. And because of people like yourself and my relationship, my friendship with Damien, and it's because of that that unlocks that door. Can you talk to us about that story of when you went back to the land of your grandmother in Kiribati?
Yeah, so I suppose for people listening, my mother's from Kiribati, which is a Pacific island, well, a group of Pacific atolls in the Pacific Ocean, halfway between, I suppose, flung out somewhere between Fiji and Hawaii, so really remote. And the main island is Tarawa, and that's where we have a family house, and whenever we, you know, that's where the flights fly into, so you go there and that's where you are, that's where we usually stay. But on a particular trip, I think I was maybe 25 or must have been 26, I went to the island, that the land of my grandmother, and it's called Matake. And Matake is another island. So whenever you go to Kiribati, if you're a Kiribati, people will say, what islands are you from? So it's almost like, yeah, what islands are you indigenous from? Where's your family from? Mm. And it sets a context. It also gives an indication of what your personality might be like, what culture you come from. Even though I hadn't been to Matake, nor had I been to Tabatuea North, which is where my grandfather's from, I would say things, I would do something and someone would say, you sit like a Matake woman.
Yeah, wow.
And I was like, oh, I don't know what that means. Like, or they're like, oh, do you have the anger like the Tabatuea North? I'm like, I don't know, maybe. Like,
cultural traits.
Yeah. Right. And so, yeah, I went to Matake. My mum was there. And when you arrive on the island, you have to do an initiation.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Wow. Which sounds scary, but it's a beautiful process where as soon as, well, I didn't know I had to do this. Well, I'd been kind of somewhat briefed, maybe as basic as, oh, you have to visit the spirits.
Yes.
Something like that. Okay. So I got there and my grandmother was there at the time. She's usually on the main island, but she was there and my mum was already on the island. I was meeting up with her and they put a garland on me, made me drink local well water, which I was a little bit scared about in terms of what my body was going to do in response to that, but I drank it anyway. And then you have to go to the four points of the island. Matake is the island of the four women. It's the women's island. And you go to the four female spirits of the island. There's a north, south, east and west. I'll say their names because I think it's respectful to do it. Mm. So there's Neire, Neirorto Benua, Neitangangu and Neinantekemem. And they are the four women that sit at the points of the island and you have to visit them. You have to explain why you're there, introduce yourself. If you are from family there, then you say what family you're from, what village you come from and where your family is, who your parents are, who your grandparents are, who your cousins are there, why you're visiting Matake, and you give them a gift. And the gift that I'd been instructed to give was a little stick of tobacco. And so I'd sort of say the thing and I had my cousin there with me and he was kind of prompting me, saying, no, you can say that in language. Or I'm like, I don't know, how do I say this? And he's like, I'll say it for you, it's fine, you know, just say whatever. And so there's the two versions of it. There's one that's really intense and this sense of identity and full respect to the spirits, but there's also this casualness of like, just go visit them. You know, you got to do it. Just, it's part of what you do. You just have, yeah, there's no way of not doing it. You just got to do it.
You just got to do it.
And so, yeah, just went around there. And then you get to the last, you get to the last spirit, the spirit of the north, and you hope that she accepts you onto the island. And so you dig into the sand, and when the ocean water runs into the hole of that you've made, you have to drink that water. And if it tastes fresh, then you're welcome.
You've been accepted.
You've been accepted. And then you rub that sand onto your face. And if it tastes salty, I suppose you leave.
Wow.
So, yeah, I did that. And doing it with my cousin, was who I had grown up with, was really wonderful and such a beautiful memory for me. So, yeah, I suppose that was like my first, like, oh, this is a place that I belong to. Like, I say my grandmother's name and everyone's like, I know exactly who you are. You know, you are, you belong here, you belong in that village over there. That is like the fish trap of your family, you know. So it was this sort of sense of, yeah, total sense of belonging. I've done it twice, thankfully. I took my partner to go and do it because I was like, you're bringing up some Mattakee daughters, you need to go there and you need to get initiated as well. So he's done it as well, and he did it in 2017. And I saw some people do it wrong. There were some Australian expats there doing it, and they were staying in a similar place where we were staying. And I was looking at my partner going, they did it wrong. Like, they're not leaving to go. They're like having dinner first before they go. And then like they said they didn't go that way. You're supposed to go like anti-clockwise. And they were just, they'd eaten something wrong that night and they were throwing up all night and left the island the next day because they were so sick. And they were like, we've had to cut our trip short. And I was like, it's the spirits. They told them to leave. They didn't do it right. So I totally believe in the spirits.
That's amazing. What a pivotal moment in your life.
Absolutely.
And Seamus's life and your partner's life. Right? What a really pivotal cultural moment in your life to just really center you into your cultural identity. And like you said, to just, it's so important to just give you that sense of belonging to a place and a people.
Yeah, I think it's especially the Australia that we live in today, and you know, we call it, well, I'm referred to and you would be referred to as a third culture kid, people that are holding that Australian culture, whatever that is, the culture they've grown up in, the culture of their parents, and then this odd culture that sits uniquely with inside of you. So it's quite confronting to go back somewhere and they just say, oh yeah, you belong here. And you think, really? Because, you know, a lot of my childhood I was wondering where I did belong. And also it's like, do I belong here? Because I also don't speak the language fluently, nor do I know the neighbours, or I've never seen this bit of land before. What do you mean I belong here? So I think it can be quite confronting. It's not as like, in a moment, enlightening, but over time there's this recognition of like, yeah, that's where I belong. That and there and this place as well.
And that's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's okay. You don't have to be from one people. You can belong to a number of them. And I certainly experienced that recently. We were in Greece last month and I said to my wife at the time, we were just sitting down and it was kind of the tail end of our trip, and she asked me, how do you feel about it? You know, and I remember saying that it feels really odd to, and I've been to Greece many times, as you know, it feels really odd to be surrounded by people that look like you.
Yes.
I felt that really odd.
Yeah.
Because the three of us, we look very different. We're from three very different cultures, right? None of our cultures are actually very similar, but in some ways they are. We're from different worlds. And that's comforting in our culture here. And that to me had me on a line of thought as we were flying home, as to about belonging and how it's not an instant thing. It actually takes some time to feel comfortable in a place where everyone looks like you, all the surnames sound like yours, the language is similar to what you grew up with. I spoke Greek, my first language. So that was a rub for me. That was friction.
Yeah.
That was really fascinating.
I remember I went to it was in Melbourne, it was a number of years ago, the was before I had kids, actually. So it was the Pacific Island Festival at the Footscray Arts Centre.
Okay.
And I was there first, and Seamus was coming down to meet me later on. He was coming in the afternoon. And when I was like, I don't know where he is. He's been, you know, he said he'd be here maybe half an hour ago, but he's not here yet. Anyway, and eventually he found me and he came up to me. He was really out of breath and kind of annoyed. He was like, oh, there you are. And I was like, what? And he's like, I've never been to a place where everyone from behind looks like you. I just could not find you. And he was like, usually I find you instantly, like long dark hair, like brown skin. I can find you in a place. And he's like, I went up to maybe five people thinking that they were my partner. He was really like, oh,
he was
I was like, oh yeah, that's true. And he's like, oh, I was like getting awkward at approaching people being like, no, it's not her. No.
Can you tell us how that trip inspired you to write your book? There was an experience there around a tsunami.
Yes. So, I mean, we talk about, here I am comfortably talking about my, you know, Kiribati identity and Pacific Islander and being very at ease in that. But I very much, for the first 20 years of my life, did not feel comfortable being, not necessarily being Pacific Islander, but I just didn't know how to speak about it. Yep. And I didn't know how to maybe hold it in my body. So, yeah, years ago I was working in London. I was there for, you know, the 2 years abroad kind of thing, and this was in 2010 or 2011, and there was a tsunami in Japan, which I was kind of like, okay, you know, I just heard about it on world news. And then my mum called me from Australia and she said, have you heard about that tsunami? And I was like, yeah, I've heard about it. And she said, well, they think it's going to ricochet back across the Pacific Ocean. And it's going to decimate Kiribati. The waves are going to be threatening the islands because Kiribati sits at about, at its highest, the atolls sit about 3 meters above sea level. So,
wow, that's not a lot, is it?
The highest, I think they've taken it down now, but the highest point in on the main island was, it was a speed bump and said someone had put aside and saying, this is the highest point on the island. It's so flat. Yeah. And so for a tsunami, it would totally decimate the islands. And so there was, you know, huge panic of like what's going to happen. And the next 24 hours were really quite scary for the family and really worrying about what was happening. And yeah, I think my grandmother climbed up a coconut tree to seek safety, which I think is hilarious. I'm like, don't get in a coconut
tree. That's awesome
she
can do that.
I know. I was really impressed. I think it was like the fastest she's ever moved in a long time. So, and we were calling back home being like, tell her to get down off the tree. Like, it's not the safest spot. Like, get in a building.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And yes, so thankfully the waves didn't have that effect in Kiribati. But in the meantime, I'm sitting in London thinking about being in Kiribati, being really far away. And this, I suppose, a sense of dread came on, thinking, what happens if the country goes underwater? And then suddenly, you know, there's about 150,000 of us, Kiribati people in the world. Okay. And so suddenly, I'm one of the Kiribati people that's holding culture and has to pass it on, carry it, when the people on the land aren't there. Yes. So that was really confronting for me. And so I didn't really know what to do about it. But I just, yeah, I started a blog called The Little Island That Could. And I just started writing, trying to figure out more about climate change and trying to understand my culture more. And I thought if I could write myself out of it, in terms of out of the questioning and try and find these answers myself, maybe it might keep me accountable. And yeah, I suppose from there, my career kind of changed. And then a few years later, I wrote a children's book about, it's called Tauti and the Wall, and Tauti is my mother. So the wall is the wall she's built around our family home on the main island to stop the water from inundating the house. So, yeah, that's, I suppose that's, it's all just like a domino effect, and then that's how the book ended up being. But I actually lied to someone and told them that I'd written a book when I hadn't. And they said, oh, great. It was actually at that Pacific Island Festival that I was speaking about. And I said, I've also got a children's book. I think I was trying to impress someone. And they said, oh, well, if you could present that at the festival, that'd be great. And, you know, maybe it comes back to being the clown. And I was like, absolutely, sure. I'll do it.
And you're like, now I've got to write it.
Yeah. And, you know, the clown, they say, never wants to get off stage. They'll say yes to everything. Absolutely. even if they don't know how to do it. Brilliant. So I was like, yes, I will have the book for you in 4 months. And so I wrote it that day. And
that's amazing.
Yeah. That's presented really it in 4 months' time.
That's really amazing. Holding culture has been really difficult for you and I, Damien, and for our generation of third culture kids, I guess. And it's really, even those words, right? I didn't even grow up hearing those words. Not even the responsibility of carrying culture through a generation was, it's just not part of the conversation. The broader conversation certainly was within the family, but that's something that we never really experienced. And that's what I find really powerful. Mm. People need to talk about it. People need to tell stories like you've just told to empower courage in others, to unlock that door within themselves, to explore their sense of identity and belonging.
Yeah, Jim, and yeah, you're completely right, Jim. And, you know, you kind of raised a good point in an earlier podcast session, Marita. We spoke about this notion of sitting between two worlds and feeling that kind of displacement. And then even when you sort of go back to, you know, Croatia, sometimes you sit there and you go, well, actually, yeah, you know, I'm a mixture of this beautiful upbringing that I was raised in this amazing country, Australia. But then I go over there and I go, well, who am I? I mean, this is... And how do I sit within those worlds? And then there was something there that kind of, you said something earlier when we were chatting, you said something around holding it in your body. It's like being embodied, sort of feeling that heart, sort of visceral connection with the place and feeling like, wow, there's something here in my bones. And I love that because, you know, that almost informs our voice, how we find our voice, our written words, our creative voice. And there's you actually can't bullshit that. It feels like it's coming through you.
Yeah.
And I think most people won't get it unless they've been to this beautiful spiritual place where just almost, I don't know, I mean, you know, I can talk about my experience, but from what hearing you talk about, it's like it just completely opens you up.
Yeah, I think, I don't know if I'm going to say it right, but sometimes I think it's fake it till you make it.
Okay.
In terms of if you go back to a culture that you have been, you are from, but so sometimes you kind of are placed in this situation and you think, am I the outsider? But if it's almost like if you think, okay, what's everyone expecting of me here? And let's see how that plays out. Like, what would it be like if I, you know, in my context, like if I were to get up and just wear like a traditional kiribati top and a sarong on my daily thing while I'm there, does that suddenly change my experience? And it did. Like it was almost like
if came you on that sort of
you take on these different personas, and I think that almost as well as like what you're putting on the external can help you find the internal as well. I remember I had this experience one time. I was in Fiji for a conference and I was there for something I'd written, and I was in my change room before speaking, and I was like, oh, you know, I'm here as an Australian representative but as a kiribati writer. So I didn't know what to wear, and I was like, do I wear my Western clothes? Do I wear, you know, I've got a number of traditional dresses and tops that I could have worn. So I was like, oh, you know, which one do I wear? And I think I'd put on my traditional dress, and then I took it off and put on a Western dress, and then put on my traditional dress, and then I probably did it a couple of times, and then I was like, stuff it, I'll go in the traditional one. So I went in the traditional one, still feeling a bit weird, because I also, people especially in Fiji would know that that's the kiribati attire, and I can't speak the language fluently, so I really felt like a fraud. But then I spoke at the conference, and it was at the University of South Pacific, so there were a lot of students in the room. And a kid, after we spoke, he said, you know, I don't feel comfortable with my identity. And he said, sometimes I just don't know how to wear it. Mm. He's like, but then seeing you speak up here with an Australian accent with a Kitabus dress on has made me think, maybe if I just put it on, would it just help me? Yeah. And I was like, you have no idea what I was doing before amazing. I came here. That's like amazing. I was just, I didn't know what to wear. So it's almost like if I make an effort for the external, it actually ricochets, and that's what you're kind of putting out to the world, yes. And then you get it reflected back to you. So I was thinking after that experience, I was like, of course I'm going to wear my dress. That's crazy. And I want a younger generation to know that you have a right to wear these clothings. You have a right to speak the language, even if it's not fluent.
Yes.
You've got a right to talk about where you're from, like just as everyone does.
In a corporate setting, in a meeting, in social setting, anywhere.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right.
That's great, Jim, isn't it? It's a great context. I mean, we're talking about leadership context, and we're talking about sort of the cultures that we sort of sometimes struggle with, and those sort of places that aren't always safe. And we don't get that sort of permission to speak through the body,
yeah.
Or to sort of embody who you are and where you come from. And then this other sort of notion that I think we've been challenging a little bit is this need to be nice, and how we dehumanize ourselves. Politeness is almost a form of almost shutting people down.
Yeah.
You know, the fake smile.
Yeah.
You know, hi, how you going? I'm good, mate. Just how are you? Just for God's sake, stop doing that. But when you've got a culture or a boardroom or an executive room full of people with that facade or those armor and that layer, what it does to people. And then you've got these beautiful stories of culture and dress and voice and land and different things like that. It's like, mate, just be you.
Yeah.
For God's sake, just be you. Like, what are we doing?
Yeah.
Okay. And then what does that do to your brain? What does it do to your anxiety, your emotions, when you've got to shut shit down that shouldn't be shut down? Which is that, and when you said, oh, hold it in my body, that's kind of what it feels like. It feels like it's an expression of your power, your voice, your love, your sincerity. And then, I mean, what are you going to do other than bring others along when you're turning up like that?
And your exploration of it as well.
Yeah.
The fact that you've arrived, like your example, you haven't actually arrived at this solution. You're actually exploring who you are.
And you know what? I can tell, talking about holding it in your body, you can tell when someone's not.
Without a doubt.
And you can tell when someone's putting on a persona or a bravado, and it's especially as you get more and more comfortable in your own, you can totally call bullshit on it. Like, well, maybe not call it, but you can see it. And you can see people, you know, in the rooms of who is comfortable and who is not, who is willing to share themselves in this space, and rather than put on the persona that they want to be projecting out there. You
smell it.
In a heartbeat.
It's political, it's corporate, it's a frigging platitude. And look, I'm calling bullshit because I know I've been there back in the day. Probably didn't have the confidence or the belief, did we, Jim, in ourselves? I mean, even when you and I grew up, it was for us to do something like that, dude, you're going to get annihilated.
Yeah, you had to be like everybody else in the meeting room. You had to turn up like them. You had to try and look like them, dress like them.
Yeah,
it was very conformist, and you know that sets up. You know, I always use the analogy, which is kind of not an analogy. It was very real. When I first started driving, and I arrived at the stoplight, I listened to Greek radio. Right, I'd put the windows up. You know, and that's what the corporate world was for me in my career. It was automatic. It was just like put the windows up because of that sort of shame that you're not like what the culture wants you to be. And it took me quite a while, as I demonstrated by meeting wonderful people like yourselves and experiencing more and more of my culture, to actually have the confidence and bravery to acknowledge, hold on. Hold on, dickhead. What the fuck are you doing? Right.
Yeah.
And I had a key moment actually in 2020, that late, right? Mm. Marita and I actually, and our colleagues, were working with an Indigenous organisation, Indigenous leadership organisation. I won't mention who they are. But we were working with a group of elders within that organisation, and we were having a discussion, and they were obviously holding that space and talking about their ancient culture and this timeless culture that exists. And one of them highlighted and paused their conversation and said, "Yes, an ancient culture like yours, Dimitri," and pointed to me through the screen. Mm. And everyone went quiet. And then the conversation continued. And it was just this moment, right? It just passed really quickly. And it stayed with me for days.
Mm.
I have a lot of esteem and respect for our Indigenous culture here in Australia, because we've done a lot of work with these organisations. It's been really good onboarding for us to understand and create empathy. To have this elder parallel me as a person and my culture with the oldest living continuous culture in the world was an immense honour. But it was also an enormous slap in the face to say, what have you done? Why have you not held your own space like we have, we're grappling with. Why have you not held? And yes, there are Greek Australians who have done remarkable work in holding that space, but why haven't you done that? And that was a key moment for me, and that was only 4 years ago.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, Jim, and sort of that, you know, I love that, because you're, you know, the work is giving you, having those moments where you give yourself permission to celebrate and love and fully embody and accept the rich beauty of all that you're bringing in.
Without a doubt. And our working lives need that.
Yes.
Yeah. When we turn up to work, Marita and I, you and I always talk about this. When we create stuff, when we write something, we default to what everyone expects to hear.
Absolutely.
And for 90% of the time, Marita and I, when we're trying to put something together, that's what we're doing. And we do it. It's autopilot, right? And we call each other and we say, what the fuck are we doing? And we remind ourselves.
Right.
For the majority of the time, we just default into this comfortable space, this safe space, that is what everyone expects, and it's vanilla. And we diminish this richness of our complete identity, which is cultural, but it's also societal. That third culture that we grew up with, this other richness that we have within ourselves and our experience, our lived experience, our trauma, bringing that into the conversation, into the creation, into the meeting. That stuff's important because it makes us who we are. And I agree, sometimes dressing helps us.
Mm.
Sometimes, for me personally, talking about it. Absolutely. Actually, it really helps us.
It's a good one, Jim. And I think, you know, when Jim and I started Fearless Conversations, it was like permission to drop in and go, dude, where are you at? What are you feeling? What's coming up for you? And it was almost that delayering of all of those armors and all of those tension points that make it hard for us to find voice.
Mm.
And so when you talk about clown work, and we've got some marvelous gents coming in next week that play in that space, but when you talk about clown work, that's another form of exploration, play, provocation, challenge. Like, how else are you going to find that stuff inside of you if you're not going to put yourself in these almost what feels like ridiculous spaces, because you are going to revert to safety, safe, vanilla, platitude, corporate, and not even knowing. And then you're in your head. So you're not going to find the magic in your head, are you? And you almost got to do some crazy shit just to keep disrupting and stuff like that. So can you tell us about that journey into your blog and how you, the connection between culture and writing? Because I think there's some amazing things that you could probably share there, I'm assuming.
Well, I think like that fake it till you make it, I don't know whether that's the right term that I should be using, but for lack of a better one, when I was writing and, you know, just trying to figure it out, that's what I was projecting out to the, I won't say world, but to the people that were reading it, saying, you know, I'm just trying to figure out my culture here. But I remember this of my childhood, or I remember this from my childhood. And, you know, my mum used to always say this, or my grandma or my grandfather said this, and my cousin said this. And gradually, as it went on, people would describe me as the Kiribati writer. And I got stopped on a plane one time coming back from Kiribati, and they said, "You're that Kiribati writer." And I'd never described myself as a writer, nor had I, nor on a flight from Kiribati had I been stopped as being the Kiribati person. I was always stopped as the Imathang, which is the white person.
Okay.
So for them to say, "Oh, you're that Kiribati writer," I was like, I suppose so. Yes, I think I am. Like, it's like the, you know, the world was kind of telling it back at me, like, this is who you are. And I was kind of like, oh, yeah. So that identity shift, it's almost how people also perceive you and what you start putting out and how it reflects back to you, how people react back to you. You suddenly think, oh, well, this is what I've been putting out to the world.
It's helpful, isn't it? It unlocks part of your mind. It unlocks part of your identity in a way that you couldn't have unlocked that yourself, or it would take longer, right? Reflecting back to you is really powerful.
Mm. And then you think, that's what I've been putting out. That's what I've been actually doing.
Yeah.
Okay. I suppose I am the Kiribati writer.
That's right.
And then suddenly you've got confidence to describe yourself as that. So that identity works hand in hand. For me, it has worked hand in hand with the work that I've done, because it empowered me to start writing more, because I'm like, well, if I am the Kiribati writer, well, then I'll write more and then I'll keep going. And then it just, like, it was this snowball effect. It just kept getting bigger and bigger.
Yeah, I love that sort of momentum. Mm. And once that, it's almost like something else starts to take over.
Yeah.
That's kind of deep inside of you. And then there's this beautiful, rich kind of, it feels like this beautiful, rich outpouring of beautiful words and beautiful content and beautiful story.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a, I don't know, I guess, you know, we've probably all in our unique way had this fascinating exploration with words, authentic voice, power, craziness, owning the fool, playing the fool, the weirdo, all that kind of rich tapestry that makes us sort of different to 8 billion people on this planet.
Yeah.
And I think we need more of that, don't we?
All the time. Like, to be honest, like, going to clown school and then after that I went to Kiribati, I was like, why did I just go to clown school? Like, I should have just come here.
Yeah.
Like, you know, people are just making fun of themselves the whole time. They are there to perform. They are there to make everyone laugh. Everyone's, you know, if you're not comfortable with people laughing at you, then you just have to get comfortable, because they want to laugh at you, because that's their form of, like, thank you for giving us entertainment and I'll entertain you back. Like,
great.
And so it's just like
that rich exchange.
Yeah. So it's
wonderful.
Be silly. Be silly.
Storytelling, I'd like to talk about.
Mm.
The three of us come from three very different cultures where storytelling is actually really important, you know, in Greek culture. You know, two of the most powerful stories that influenced Western civilization, the Iliad and the Odyssey, were poems that were told verbally, not written down for generations, and now held up as, you know, wonderful artifacts.
Yeah.
The art of sitting down and having discourse, debate and dialogue, which means we don't have to agree, but let's take the time to just sit. That's very rich in my culture. And that's something, I think we mentioned it a couple of weeks ago, Damien, something we don't really see. We're constantly rushing to the next thing.
Mm.
And that richness of in Kiribati, where you're connecting and experiencing, as you described, is a really wonderful way of telling story, isn't it?
Yeah. I read a great book called Always Another Country by Sisonke Masiman. I think that's how you say her name. She's a South African writer who resides in Australia. And in her book she says, we are nothing but stories.
Mm.
Like, that's all we are. And I remember reading it thinking, is that all I am? Is that all we are? And I really love that. Like, the stories you leave behind, the stories you pass on, the stories we tell, that's all that's left after we go, the story of you or your family, it's, and that's how, you know, that's how you hold culture. That's how you share culture. That's, you know, I have a responsibility to learn more stories so I can pass them on to my children. It's their responsibility to decide whether they take them on and they pass them on, but that's their own journey that they need to go on to. But yeah, it's for me and the generation that I'm in, I need to listen to the stories. And as I get older, I have more and more respect of an elder generation. Listen to the stories, take them on board and pass them on. They can change. Of course, that's going to happen. And I think there's an acceptance that that's what happens because they evolve and they're never going, the stories aren't static. They just keep evolving. And if anything, they start responding to the time on the place that they're told and then they get passed on. So yeah, I don't think we are anything but stories and the story leave behind.
I completely agree. Many years ago, 15 years ago, my father was hit by a car as he was walking over a zebra crossing. The car didn't stop. He was thrown 10, 15 metres and he spent 6 months in hospital. He couldn't walk. He had to learn how to walk. He had pins and he was paralysed from the hips down.
Oh, my God.
And he regained movement in his legs in the fifth or sixth month and he was out back home. I remember the day when I went back to the trauma ward in Epworth Hospital and he was standing up for the first time in 6 months on a walker. My father's still alive. He's almost 89. Wow. During that period, just going back to We Are Nothing But Stories, I gave Dad a blank journal and a pen because he was in bed. He couldn't move. Right? And I just gave it to him because my dad, in our family, they call him the archive.
Oh.
He'll ring you on your birthday. He'll remember your birthday, yeah. So my relatives, my cousins from Greece call him when they have a question. What was this guy's name at so-and-so in 1935 when did this, this and that? Who was, you know, the army officer in 1955 who did this? And my dad will know. Right? So Dad started writing just stories of his life in this journal. And he's up to 2 volumes now. He just continued doing that after he came back home from hospital and throughout the years. And those volumes are at his house. And every now and then I just look at an empty volume, an empty journal, I think, I'm going to give that to Dad. Because those stories, I've read some, but I try not to. It's not the right time to read them. Those stories are really special. He tells me about them because, oh, today I wrote about this, and he tells me. The day we were chased by Nazis through the village because we were throwing rocks at the school. They got, and a window broke. His primary school was taken over by Nazis during the war. These little stories make us. So that We Are Nothing But Stories is so very true. And I think we're also made up of how we tell those stories together, how we share them.
It's a great little vignette there, Jim, with your dad and sort of that beautiful, wise sort of elder that he is. And, you know, they had just such beautiful wisdom. And they think, yeah, these are the stories. These are the stories that matter. This is how we connect. And then on the other hand, and, you know, we spoke about good trouble in our podcast. And this is the provocation to say the culture at the moment is going to make you feel like shit. It's about stuff. It's not about stories. It's about acquisition. It's about climbing. Right. It's about, you know, that next growth that you've got to have. And so we've got to provoke that. We're going to say, if that's making you feel like garbage, then, mate, just get rid of it. Challenge it and just challenge these norms that we tell ourselves within the marketing and advertising culture, which says you're not enough and you need more stuff or you need to climb more or you need to have that. And if it's kind of making you feel like crap, then you've got to go back to those beautiful stories that kind of express our identity, express what matters, express human connection. And of course we've got to put food on the table. We live in the world. We're grounded in reality. Yeah. But there is another part of that where there's something so sick within our culture at the moment that if you get caught up in it, you are going to feel like garbage. You're going to be comparing, you're going to be rating because these messages come through the ether at a million miles an hour.
I'm going to call you up on something.
Go for it.
You said, of course, we've got to put food on the table. I think that's an excuse.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that is what leads us sitting there in the groove, accepting the status quo. Oh, I've got to put food on the table, so I've got to conform. Mm.
Yeah.
I've got to just do the thing and cop it. I've got to look like all of them. I've got to turn up and dress like all of them.
We hide behind that.
Yeah.
Yeah, we use that as a get out of jail card.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. That's what I'm trying to say is that is our get out of jail card. It's an excuse. And I think, and I've certainly tried this in my business, I think you've got to find new grooves. I think you've got to find new ways of structuring a business, turning up in the world, advocating for issues that matter to you as an individual, as a leader, and therefore the issues that your organization advocates for. I think, I don't want to pile on you.
No. It's good pile on, mate. We love pile on.
Yeah. I think, of course, we've got to put food on the table. And I use that excuse a lot too. It's an excuse, you know?
Yeah, I think I agree. I think it's a way of us saying, oh, I can't get out of the situation that I'm in.
Mm.
I can't change whatever. And, you know, I will acknowledge that I am privileged, you know, living in Australia, having an education. And I've always thought, I would say majority of the times that I've left a job in my life, I've quit it without knowing where else I'm going to go. But I've always had this thought being like, I'm smart. I can work this out. Mm. Surely. Like,
yes.
I'm not going to let myself starve. I'm not going to let my family starve. I mean, I don't really know where the next paycheck is going to come from, but I'm not an idiot. I'll work it out, and I will use my brains to somehow get a paycheck. And I think I see that excuse come up a lot where people go, oh, no, I can't do that. I'd love to travel more, or I'd love to do this, but just wait until we've got some sort of financial security. And I understand that, but, you know, a lot of people, especially at the time that I was having children, I mean, I fell pregnant without a job, and it was a planned pregnancy, but also I was like, well, I don't actually have any maternity leave, but we'll work it out. Like, my parents did this, the other generations did this. You know, I don't think I'm going to wait around for maternity leave just to wait to have a child, because I want the child. That's what I want. Like, I don't want maternity leave. Mm. And so, you know, it was really hard. The first year of having a child was really hard, very financially hard. And, you know, we managed to get our way through it. But I see those examples come up time and time again where people just are yearning so much for the security that it delays the things that they really want in life. And I think we use it as a default to fall back on. And yeah, you have to be, you have to figure out a way to put food on the table, but there's many different ways to do that. And it's not the only way that you're currently in. So that's the only way to do it.
That's right. And this whole notion we get asked a lot about, because we're one of the Australia's older B Corps, one of the earliest accredited B Corps. We're on our fourth accreditation wave, I think. We get asked about how to do meaningful, good, impactful work a lot. And we see a lot of businesses come to us who do that as a side project, you know, and their excuse is because we've got to put food on the table, right? It's like they accept that to turn up into the world to do good, and the narrative of our conversation is connecting to our identity and belonging, which is doing good. You do that at the mercy of everything else, which is not true at all.
I remember that meeting we had, Jim, a meeting where we walked away from a client, and it was such a big turning point for me in a lesson of leadership, seeing leadership happen and seeing what you, like, holding your integrity in a room. And I remember we're going to this meeting, we knew it wasn't going to go well. And I remember thinking, okay, what are we going to do in here? We're going to say this, and I'm going to talk about this, and, you know, I'll apologize for this bit. And we're in an Uber on the way, and I remember, Jim, you said to me, just forget it. Look at these photos of my kids. Aren't they great? Like, and I was kind of like, aren't we preparing for our meeting? Yeah. Like, okay, sure. And then we left that meeting with so much integrity. We told the client, you told the client, I watched and in awe being like, this is happening. And you said, it's not working out. And we're not working in a way that is meaningful and looking after each other. We're not taking care of each other. And it's, this work isn't good for us. This approach to work is not good for us. And we're going to have to walk away from that. And we are okay with that. Mm. And I remember leaving the room knowing that you've held your integrity and your values and your true beliefs in that space going, no, that's the line and I'm going to leave it there. It was it was a big lesson for me.
Oh, thank you. Should have been there, Damo. It was pretty good.
Yeah, I missed out.
It was good.
And I do, my kids send to me and they're a reminder of why we're here, all of us, right? Just for our children and our families, our small communities, our close friendships. That really centers me and it's a nice reminder. And I constantly do that. I'm constantly looking at them as a reminder as to why I'm actually sitting here doing this with you guys, you know, because it's energy well spent.
Mm. Yeah, it is that reminder that lets it, you know, whether you talk about legacy and stories, and I love that sort of story legacy connection. And this sort of a question around what is the work, what's meaningful, what matters. I don't think there's this like massive sort of, you know, you've got to do this right now and you've got to, you know, live a meaningful life. And if you don't, you know, it's just not right. That's another judgment, right? Mm. But maybe the question, because a lot of people are going to be listening to this sort of dialogue and thinking, okay, where do I sit within this? Maybe it's just a really honest provocation around what matters to me. What's putting fuel into my body? What's getting my spirit alive? And that's, wherever that ends up is okay. But if you're not even asking that question, then I don't know. I think your body's going to – we are probably bang on about this all the time. Your body's going to tell you pretty quickly.
Mm. Well, looking inward is hard and not encouraged, right? Because we're encouraged to look outward. We have to read that book. We have to wear the right clothes. We have to look outward. We have to connect with the right people. We have to network. Looking inward is not encouraged, yet it is the work.
Well, looking inward, if you haven't done it before, is going to be terrifying for some people. Because you've got to change shit. You've got to say, this situation isn't right. And if I have to change it, what does that mean? So what does that mean for my financial security, inverted commas? What do I have to give up? But if you don't do that at some level over some period of time, dude, shit's going to happen. Or you're going to disconnect or you disengage and you're not there with the people around you. And you're carrying just trauma, tension, anxiety. And then when you talk, it's coming out like a version of you.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe is that too
No,
is that
I think
too much?
It's your mother must be a remarkable woman to have enabled all of this for you.
Yes, she is. I often put her up on a pedestal because I've got so much respect for her, but at the same time, you know, she is my mum. We argue, if not daily, then weekly. And
that's great.
You know, I recently had to tell her off because she unknowingly taught my daughters the F word. So, so that was a conversation that needed to happen, where I felt like the elder. Uh-huh. But there's a lot more. I'm really trying to encourage her. She's held on to so many stories and I'm really trying to encourage for her to share those stories but also celebrate them because also she came to Australia when she was 21.
Wow.
In a small country town. She brought up two daughters and she is, yeah, so she for a lot of her life felt like she had to hide those stories because, you know, they weren't celebrated. She had to conform. Mm. And she did to get her family through. And, you know, I suppose bringing up daughters in an Australian context, she did what she needed to do to ensure that, you know, we felt, in inverted commas, normal or we didn't stick out. And so, whereas now I'm just, like more stories. Come on, like, give me more, give me more. And I'm trying every project that I'm working on where I can, I try and bring her on as a consultant. And
how good is that alone? Love that. Right? Can you imagine our parents doing that?
Yeah.
Like, that's amazing. Oh, just that alone. That's
great. She's just like, I mean, she's a wealth of knowledge. Mm. And, you know, I didn't just learn that just from listening to her. I had a lot of other people being like, your mum knows a lot. Mm. Like, and I'd say, oh, who can tell me about this and tell me about this? And I'd ask external people, like, who can talk to me about this? And they'd say, your mother.
Yeah.
She knows this stuff. She knows so much. Like, she was, you know, not just because she's Ikitabus, but she's a big lover of Indigenous stories, Kitabus stories. She's a teacher. And so she's collected these stories over time. So, yeah, I love bringing her on as a consultant, and also just her way of working. Now, whenever I have her as a consultant for work, you know, the first thing is Kitabus culture is that there's always three songs for any meeting. You have three songs, one in the middle, one at the end, one at the start. And so, you know, you sit down and we go, okay, well, this is our agenda. And Mum's like, our song first. Like, oh, okay.
Brilliant.
Yep, song first, you know. And especially if we've got other people who aren't part of our culture in the room, they're like, oh, your mum said that we need to sing. Like, what do we do? Okay, sure. And she was like, I'll sing it. You don't know the words, but you do the movements. Copy me. We'll do this. It, you know, it goes for minutes. Just get it over and done with. And right. So we have to get in the
room. She's a matriarch, which is awesome.
Total matriarch.
Yeah.
We have that structure now. Whenever she's there, we have the song, start, middle and end. She just knows how to hold it. And also bringing her with me into the work, I'm seeing more and more of her willingness to share culture. And I if anything, she's just amazed that we're now in a culture of like where this stuff is celebrated, and it's, you know, growing more and more. I just think we need to be celebrating our matriarchs and our patriarchal stories, like bring them in, particularly, you know, I'm from a women's island, so I'll focus on matriarchs. But I just think holding these stories and bringing elders into the room creates such an opportunity. There's so much wealth and there's so much knowledge. Like, there's just, we've got to get them in the
room.
Where are they?
I've seen Marita's mum in action at the Kiribati Festival in Kyneton, and she's a firecracker. She's a remarkable woman. She's a wonderful dancer, by the way. And I can certainly see that matriarchal quality where everything just revolves around them. They're the center of everything revolving around, which is really wonderful. But where are they?
How are they?
In our consultations, in our research, in our engagements, in our conversations, in the mix of our boards. Where are those elders that are wise and have lived experience to consult with and listen to?
Yeah.
Like our parents who are, I guess, archives of knowledge.
Yeah, they are. Mm. And it makes me think more, the more I use her, the more I'm thinking, I can see spaces where I'm like, we could get an elder in there. How do we get another generation in that room? And even our, like, younger generation as well, where are they? Like, bring them in.
Yeah.
Bring those ideas in and have these cross-generational consultation processes. I would love to be seeing more of it because I just think it's untapped knowledge. Like new knowledge paired with old knowledge together, there's so much to learn.
That's where the magic happens. That's right. One thing that my kids were really confronted by or highlighted from our recent trip to Greece was how culturally all ages exist together in all aspects. There's no, the young people go off here and the older people sit over there and have their own discussion. It's all together, all the time, within a family. That we were talking about that with our kids, a couple of teenagers, an eight-year-old, and that was really foreign to them in our culture here where, you know, the elders are actually off over there and the different age groups over there and us in the middle sort of sit here. Very different way of approaching cohesion within a community.
Yeah.
You know, and really connecting, like you said, all age groups
And I think that's key to a younger generation growing up to have, well, respect or just that honouring an older generation. It's the key for the younger generation to start to acknowledge that, oh, they belong in these spaces. The elder generation, they belong. Like, it's not necessarily that they're invited in. It's just this is what the room should be looking like.
Because they're going to be elders one day.
Yeah.
And how best to learn.
Yeah, absolutely.
I certainly became closer to my father during that time that I described earlier. More than any other time in my life, really brought us closer together. And I realized the richness of having an elder close.
Mm.
And my extended family also realized that as well. When we tap into that knowledge of my father, my uncles, we now, as we're getting older, we tap into that all the time. Do you do that, your family?
Probably not as well as I could, to be honest, Jim. And when I think about it, and even when I just think about older generations in the community, I had this magnificent older lady come up to me the other day whilst I was just sitting at a cafe with my dog, and she approached me and said, "May I pet your dog?" And she told me she was 85. And we had a half an hour conversation. She'd lived in Elwood for 57 years, and she just wanted to chat. I just thought, how cool is this that I get to have this beautiful exchange by someone that had probably the courage to walk up to someone, a random person, and have a conversation. And then why am I not doing that? Like, why did it take her to do that for me? And then how did I feel after that exchange? Alive, full, and there's this beautiful exchange of wisdom within us. But that's the exception. That actually doesn't happen.
Doesn't.
And so what is it about her that she went up to me, and what is it about other exchanges where people might feel a bit awkward, or those people are too young and cool, or what? That's not cultural connection. That's just people sitting in their boxes.
Yeah.
You know, someone's sitting in the corner and chatting to their two cool mates, and you've got these beautiful conversations happening here. I mean, what is community if we're not going to be able to connect at some level across that? Because we're missing out. We're missing out if we can't do that.
We're missing, there's so many lessons to be learning from just neighbourhood chats, community being able to open up and feel like they can have these conversations that are meaningful for both sides. It's just, it makes me feel kind of sad that we do sit in these boxes and we do our own siloed ways of living, and I wish we had more opportunity to be, you know, these cross-sharing of cultures and learnings and passing on of stories. I just wish we had more opportunity.
Yeah, and Marita, when you talk about the way you engage, you know, back in your homeland, and I even think about, like, often in Croatian culture, we can be quite loud.
Yeah.
We're very expressive, and we'll walk into a cafe or someone and go, "Hey, what's going on?" You know, we'll shout at the dude across the street. I've tried it a few times, and everyone's like, "Is this weirdo? Just tone it down, mate." And I'm like, no way. Come on, man. I could just walk around like a bloody icebox with a stupid fake smile on my face and be really quiet. Like, that's bullshit.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I mean, I'm mindful of where people are and all that stuff, but isn't it that we want the more craziness and more expression and more silliness and more expansion and connection? Isn't that what the fuel is for human life?
In Greek culture, we greet each other with two kisses, one on each cheek within our family. Like, it's never one. It's always one and one on the other. That's the hello. Mm. Men, kids, it's all just common. And it's really beautiful, and it's very tactile. Like,
there's a lot of affection.
A lot of hugging, a lot of affection, and you see a lot of men doing that. You see a lot of men sitting together, talking, discussing, open, vulnerable conversations out in public. You know, it's really wonderful, and it's very common to have that. And you also get other extremes. Let me not paint an entire culture with one brush. Right? Mm. You get other extremes, of course. But those cultural traits are very prevalent in my culture, absolutely. It's really wonderful.
And, you know, just to sort of, I know we're sort of rounding this conversation out, and we started with your story, and then kind of always these principles around authentic voice, where your power comes from, and when you're holding on to tension. And when what that does to you, not just your voice, your spirit, and your expression, whether it's written or verbal. And so I think this sort of whole delayering of sort of you know, false layers and what's left behind? What's that exploration look like? And then what does it feel like to sound like you? What does it feel like to write like you? Mm. And what do we need to do to kind of explore that? What are the crazy things we've got to do? What are the beautiful things we need to do? Yeah. And I think that's probably a lot what we're sort of inviting our listeners to think about.
I think I was chatting to a cousin of mine, and we often talk about career and holding our culture and, you know, what are we doing for that? And she often messages me saying, your ancestors are so proud of you right now, which that makes me tear up. Like, I'm just like, well, your ancestors are proud of you. And so there is security in thinking, well, this isn't actually about me. This is actually about my ancestors. Yeah, wow. If I'm making them proud, then I should be on the right path. Mm. Yeah, so if you think about it, like, okay, it's not about me. It's what I'm using the skills that my ancestors have passed on, and I just got to use it because they're telling me to. I'm not of any particular faith, but I do go back to ancestors and the skills they pass on to me, and am I using them to the full effect that, you know, I've been given. So I get a lot of comfort from that. And I feel like a lot of people should be thinking it's not only for, you know, me being from an Indigenous culture. It's not just for Indigenous people who are able to say, what have our ancestors given us? Yeah. I feel like sometimes we only talk about ancestors in terms of coming from an Indigenous culture, but it's for all of us. Like, what have our ancestors passed on to us, and how are we using that for good? So I get a lot of comfort. I just think, okay, if that's a path. So, but it's also very good to have someone nearby you to be like, your ancestors are proud of you.
Mm, like, that's amazing.
We should say it more, I think.
That's and acknowledging that the three of us are from Indigenous cultures and have ancestors that would be very proud of us just simply having this conversation.
Absolutely. And like, how amazing is this? The three of us in a room.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
It's pretty cool.
And Marita, I think you really embody what you said at the beginning of our conversation, finding what it is that's unique about you and simply showing the joy of that to the world.
Yeah.
I think you embody that. And it's been wonderful chatting to you. It really has. And I knew it would be because we chat every day anyway.
Yeah, we do.
And I think it's really special that we had an opportunity to do this today.
It's a real gift, Marita. And it's, you know, what a beautiful way to sort of close this out in this sort of beautiful expression that you've just given us. It's a real gift because we're giving people this love and this juice and this sort of just almost this beautiful inquiry around, well, what does it take for me to find my voice? What does it take for me to celebrate my ancestry, my culture? And it's not just for me, it's something I'm going to take out. When you said those words, I'm like, whoa. that's a pretty powerful way to engage in the world, whether it's through voice, words, and being with others. It's not just for me,
it's
also for my ancestors. And I'm really going to take that one out, so thank you.
No worries. Thank you very much for having me. And I always cry, so, you know, I feel like it's not a Marita chat without a cry. So.
No, bring it on. You need to do more. We need to do more of that. Absolutely.
Thank you, Marita.
Thank you,
Marita. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Damien Carolla, and I've been playing in the human development and high performance space for a few decades now and run a coaching practice called Mentor Hub. I work with entrepreneurs, athletes, CEOs and leaders on the topics of change and transformation, leadership and culture. What's central to my work is that we create safe, empowering and inspiring spaces for people to realise their potential. And I work with leaders and organisations across a diverse range of sectors, from building, construction and technology through to retail and social enterprise. You know, lately I've been collaborating with leaders and teams around the topics of mental resilience and agility. You know, we use a lot of storytelling, open dialogue to help leaders and teams redefine what it means to build resilience and flexibility across a chaotic world. I believe in the power of the human condition and that each one of us is here to realize our full potential. And so Fearless Conversations is a series of dialogue sessions where we get to peel back the layers and really explore the things that matter most. It's a conversation between two good friends that care deeply about people and the worlds in which we live.
Hi, I'm Jim Antonopoulos, Actually, my name is Dimitri, but we'll get into that another time. I'm the Managing Director of Strategy and Transformation Consultancy, Tank. We're based in Melbourne, Australia. As one of Australia's earliest B Corp accredited businesses, we work across a number of impact areas on change and transformation programs, empowering young women, sustainable and affordable housing, financial literacy for underrepresented communities, accessible quality education, meaningful workplace cultures, and cultural diversity and inclusion being some of them. My team and I bring empathy and meaning to impact organisations, and we believe that every business and every leader can be good, ethical, and purpose-driven, or at least they should be. Most importantly, I'm a father of three amazing people, and I work tirelessly to leave the world in a better place for them. Our podcast continues thanks to your support. Listeners like you who have shared our podcast with your networks on LinkedIn and other social platforms have meant the world to us. It has motivated us to continue doing what we do. If you would like to support this podcast and keep it free of advertising forever, please head on over to marchfirst.com.au/podcast, where you can donate to support our show and share the link with your friends and networks.